Today, sex, love, loss, longing, midlife crises, and midnight runs to come and go. A hot, steamy summer in Grinnell, Iowa is the setting for the new novel, Summer Long. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Dean Bacopoulos' third novel, and many are calling it his breakthrough novel. I'll talk with him about Summer Long and the politics of setting a novel where you live and work. Later in the hour, author Benjamin Percy has taken his literary talents to the world of comic books. This summer, he's taking Green Arrow in a dark new direction. I'll talk with him as well. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, two novelists with Iowa ties who are trying some new things this summer. Later this hour, Benjamin Percy is getting into the superhero business, writing Green Arrow comic books. But first, Dean Bacopoulos is the writer in residence of English at Grinnell College. He has just released his third novel, which takes place during a long, hot summer in Grinnell. It's called Summer Long. The book comes out today, and he'll be celebrating with a launch party and reading at 7 p.m. at Relish in Grinnell. He's in the studio with me today. Welcome back, Dean.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I have so many questions for you, but I think it would be great if we start with a little scene from the book where one of the characters, Claire Lowry, goes out for a midnight run. Can you set this up for us a little bit?
Sure. This is kind of one of the first scenes that occurred to me when I was writing the book. I was living in Grinnell. It was a very hot summer. It was a hot spring, actually. It was, I think, April 2012. And I was trying to get into a new novel, having just failed a couple attempts at other novels. And I was wandering around the town. It was a really warm night. I couldn't sleep. And I saw a woman who I never had seen before, about my age, a little bit younger. And she just looked miserable, and I've never seen her in Grinnell again, so I have no idea who it actually is, but she was near the ice machine. And for some reason in my head, I started to ask the question, which I think most novelists ask, like, what if she was out there because of this particular reason? So I invented a kind of story for her, and that's how this scene started. So I'm going to read to you. It's about 25 pages into the book. It's an early scene where this woman, Claire Lowry, a mother of two, who's lived in Grinnell for a long time. She's a writer who's kind of failed to ever write another book after an early debut in her 20s. And she encounters a man named Charlie Gulliver, whose father was a professor at Grinnell and who's come back to clean out his father's office. And I'll begin where Charlie sees Claire. He's inside buying beer, and she's outside in the parking lot. This woman had the clearest eyes he had ever seen. He knows this because she is staring at him as if trying to place him, and he knows, too, that he has seen her before. But he would probably have been in high school then, maybe 12 years ago or more. He's not been back here much. At least she has stopped kicking the ice machine. "You don't by chance have a cigarette," she asks. His hands are full. He has a 12-pack of Moosehead in his hands. A plastic sack of groceries hangs from each hand as well. "Sure," he says. "Follow me. I'll set this down." She scans him, looks to the minivan parked in a dark corner of the lot. "I grew up here," he says, when she seems to notice his Washington plates. "I just got in from a long, long drive." She follows him, and he sets his groceries on the slanted hood of the van. He opens the box of Moosehead then, pulls out two bottles, cracks them open with his key ring, and offers her one. She steps into the shadows, out of the light, takes the beer and drinks it. "Are you 21? She says. 29. Just making sure. If the cops come, I'd like to keep this to a misdemeanor. "I don't think Ashlyn will call the cops. What's your brand?" She looks at him puzzled. "Of cigarettes." "Right. Whatever you got. Marlboro used to be my brand. Lights." He sets down his beer, goes into the convenience store, and faces the now scowling clerk. "You know her?" the clerk asks. "She your friend?" "I don't know, Ashy," he says, smiling. "She might be. Marlboro lights? In a box?" "I almost called the cops, Charlie. You tell her that." "She's cool. I told you I would take care of it."
Dean Bacopoulos reading from Summer Long. Dean, you're not originally from Iowa, and I know that you grew up in Michigan. You've spent a lot of time in other parts of the Midwest as well. I found that being somebody from Iowa, when people find out that we have a convenience store chain called Come and Go, they love that.
Right, right.
We used to actually, my husband would buy Come and Go branded things to take back to our friends in Michigan because they loved that so much. So was there a little bit of just fascination with it's, Come and Go that started this?
Sure, it's such a bizarre spelling for a chain to have, and they're really everywhere, and people from out of state, never quite can figure out what's going on with that marketing decision. And so yeah, I actually buy Come and Go merchandise for writers all the time. It's a gift you bring from Iowa now. It's become kind of an Iowa calling card. And certainly, in Grinnell, the students, that's one of the few places you can go in the middle of the night for any sort of food. And students tend to stay up all night. So it does become, in a small college town like Grinnell, a weird little hub. If it's 3 in the morning and you want to go anywhere in Grinnell, you're going to be at the Come and Go.
So you were for this, you went for this walk on a very hot summer night, saw the woman at the Come and Go. What happened next? How did this novel spring from that?
Well, I started to write on a strange schedule at that time. I would come home from teaching. This was, spring of 2012, this felt like a summer already. It was a very hot.
Well, that
spring.
Was the summer of the drought. I mean, that was a very, very hot, long summer.
Yeah, it was a freakily hot summer, and I think that alone caused some anxiety for people. How quickly it got, into the 90s in April, and so. What I would do is I'd come home from teaching at Grinnell, and at the time I lived like 2 blocks from campus. I'd have dinner with my family, put the kids to bed, and then I'd wake up around midnight, almost every night, and I'd be unable to get back to sleep and start writing. And so I'd write this book from, about midnight to 4 a.m. every night, and then I'd go back to bed. And there's not a whole lot to do to take a break at midnight. Like, you can't even go on Facebook because everyone's asleep. There's not even anything new popping up online. So I would take walks to kind of stretch out my back and to clear my head. And so I think what if I'm remembering it right, I just came home and started writing. And I wrote, a scene in which a woman kicks the ice machine. And what happens a little bit later in the scene, quite unsolicited, she turns to Charlie, the stranger she just met, and she blurts out the line, "I've wasted my life." And once she did that, I realized that she was going to start blurting out things she shouldn't. And to me, that's always a great engine for a plot when characters ask or think things that they can't take back.
When you started writing this, I mean, you said that it was after a couple of other things you were working on just didn't work out. When you started writing this, did you think that it was going to be a novel?
This is the first time where I did. I think, I saw the whole thing. I wasn't sure how I was going to get there, and it went through many different drafts and different iterations. But I've been playing with probably since my first book came out in 2005, I've been playing with the idea of setting something in a small, more rural town. My first 2 books, my first book is set in Detroit. My second book is set in Madison, Wisconsin. And so I was trying to figure out a way into a novel about marriage in a small town, in a more sort of isolated place. And but once I got the characters, I sort of knew I had something. Yeah.
And you obviously took your inspiration from Grinnell, but living in Grinnell, working in Grinnell, did you have any misgivings about actually using Grinnell in the book?
I think my friends and family might have had more misgivings than I did. I'm a fiction writer, but I'm a fiction writer who really minds my personal life for material. I think that partly comes from just being busy, from being a teacher and a parent and having so many other responsibilities to juggle. I can't immerse myself in research, about some plague that happened in the 16th century. I'm not going to write anything set, in Italy in 1904. I just can't do that. My imagination doesn't really work that way. My imagination really more is born of a really anxious mess of personal demons. And so when that happens, when you're that type of writer, you really do have to write about where you're at that moment. And so for me, there wasn't much of a choice once I found this book. A few people did suggest you make up a college, you make up a town,
similar to Grinnell.
Yeah. But I love the way fiction and nonfiction overlap. And I love those things that readers can find that they recognize. And I love that as a reader. So, you know, part of the way you finish a novel is make it fun for yourself. It's really hard to finish a novel that's not fun to write. And so it was just fun for me to sort of, you know, live in this imaginary Grinnell aside the real one during the day.
Not very many good decisions are made in the course of this book. Mm-hmm. So I can understand how other people may have had some misgivings about it taking place in Grinnell. And I can imagine that, I mean, this is release day. So once people start reading this, there will be a lot of questions, particularly from people who live in Grinnell. Were you worried about that at all, that people would think you were writing about real people?
You know, I didn't so much because I feel like, you know, by your third book, people kind of know you make stuff up. And I think my first two books are really embellished versions of reality, and they feel very much like fictive worlds. But I do think people do read books to try to see if they're in there or if they know people in there. This really is purely fictional. And people say I'm just maybe saying that as a defense mechanism. But it's really true. If anything, the five main characters all contain like some of my own traits. And it's as if I split myself into a bunch of different characters and then added a bunch of things to them. So I'm hoping people don't see anyone they recognize. I really did try, other than a few like little cameos by people in town that are more like nods and kind of in fun, but they're not critical. I think the people who make the worst decisions are pretty much totally fictional, or at least maybe versions of myself that I've made more interesting. You know, if you didn't have characters that made bad decisions, you wouldn't have literature. You know, Shakespeare is all about people making really bad decisions. And so I love that idea of escalating a story through people doing things that they can't undo. And that's really the kind of work I'm interested in.
If people are looking for you in this book, you certainly haven't quashed that that kind of rumor with what you just said.
Well, I think a writer is always in the book, you know. I have a friend who wrote a very sort of controversial novel with a character who, you know, was sociopathic. And it's totally fictionalized. But at the same time, if you know the writer, you know, every so often there's little hints of the writer's, you know, worst things in there. You know, for instance, like Don Lowry smokes a lot of pot. I don't smoke pot. I'm not interested in it. It doesn't do anything for me. So I think people will think that, you know, I'm high all the time and I worry about that kind of thing. But for the purpose of the book, Don Lowry had to do some things like that.
Right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Dean Bacopoulos. His new novel is Summer Long, and it takes place in Grinnell, Iowa. He's having a book release party tonight in Grinnell, Iowa at Relish at 7 p.m. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll be talking with author Benjamin Percy, who is writing a comic book this summer. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. With me right now is Dean Bacopoulos. He's the writer in residence of English at Grinnell College. He's also just released his third novel, or I guess you're in the process of releasing it right
today's
now.
Today's the day,
as we speak. The book comes out today. He'll be celebrating with a launch party and reading at 7 p.m. at Relish in Grinnell. And just before the break, you were talking about Don Lowry and how he smokes a lot of pot and you don't.
Right.
But can you read a little bit from the book and introduce us to Don Lowry?
Sure. Don Lowry was a character who, when he showed up in my brain, this is where I really knew I had a novel. I had Claire at the come and go, as I talked about a little bit earlier. And then I tried to figure out, okay, who is her husband? And he's a real estate agent in Grinnell, and I have a really good friend who's a real estate agent in Grinnell, and I keep having to assure people that, like, it's just coincidental. Like, you know, Don Lowry, why I made him a real estate agent is partly because he's in serious financial trouble when the book opens. His house has gone into foreclosure, and it's sort of a big shame for him that as this, like, supposedly successful realtor, he's really behind on his mortgage, and he's losing his house. He hasn't told his wife, Claire, that they're about 30 days out from being kicked out of their home. And real estate has always been my little obsession. So I thought, I always think if I hadn't been a novelist, I would have really gone into real estate. I look at real estate listings kind of obsessively.
Well, it is interesting because it gives him a window into so many people's lives mm-hmm. and keys to their homes as well.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing that he knows where everybody lives. And I think he grew up in this town, and then he went to Grinnell College on a scholarship for local kids, and then never really expected to be there. And now in a weird way, he's kind of the guy who sets people up. And what he realizes as the novel begins is that his role in the town is maybe not is not a stable one, and that he's in a very precarious situation personally and financially. So I'll just read. These are the opening two paragraphs of the novel where we first see Don Lowry. In the hay gold dusk of late spring, Don Lowry takes his usual walk through town and out to the fields beyond it. In the newly turned black earth, he smells energy and promise, which buoys him in a way he has not felt buoyed in some time, and he feels, along with the whole twitching prairie, as if he is on the verge of something either beautiful or terrible. It is always hard for him to know which. And this is why, while walking home, when he sees a woman, her body sprawled beneath a thick, scabbed-up sycamore at the darkening edge of Merrill Park, he believes that she's fallen from a high bough. Don stops at the edge of the park, reaching for his phone to call 911, but he does not bring his phone on these walks. His wife has urged him not to. He works too much. He has chest pains at night, and his face is often lit by a screen. And so he cannot call anyone. From this downhill angle, it's unknowable. Has a woman, in fact, fallen from the tree, or has she injured or been beaten in some way? But as he approaches her, it seems as if she has simply sprawled there for the pleasure of it, for the soft grass and a few stars salting the darkening sky, and the moon, an icy coin. For a moment, he wants to lie down next to her and whisper her name.
Dean Pacopoulos reading from his new novel, Summer Long. And both Don Lowry and Claire Lowry are both, well, they're about your age. They're about my age. And I mean, they're both going through this incredibly difficult time in their lives when so much of how you describe them feels universal to those of us who have way too many responsibilities. Just the overwhelmingness of everyday life, the description of Claire looking around the kitchen and just not even being able to imagine cleaning it up. I mean, was that something that really resonated with you and something that you observed in friends and other people reaching about that same point?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that feeling of overwhelm is really what begins this novel. It's overwhelm that is coupled with the questioning of why. Why are we so overwhelmed? You know, and for sometimes it's just you're too busy and that you are doing way too much and you're trying to be perfect. And I think perfectionism, you know, I'll be 40 this summer, and for my generation, I think perfectionism might be our curse. We went to college during the Clinton years where there was tons of jobs and tons of credit and tons of choices available to us. And I think that we find ourselves now reaching 40 and realizing we couldn't have possibly done all the things that were available to us. And so you end up in this weird feeling that you didn't live the perfect life. And it's a position, you know, that also comes with some guilt because you know you've been privileged, you know you've been lucky, and yet you still have this kind of nagging unhappiness. And sometimes it's just a lifestyle change. You just have to kind of cut some things out and refocus your priorities at midlife. Your kids are a little bit older. You don't have babies anymore. Your career's kind of launched. And that refocusing for a lot of people can bring happiness and contentment. But sometimes it's that you're in the wrong space. You're in the wrong job. You're in the wrong place. You're in the wrong marriage. And that is where this novel, I think, really goes into the deeper feeling of overwhelm. It's not just busyness. It's that maybe the life they set up isn't the right life anymore. And that's a terrifying thing to realize.
Claire is a particularly heart-wrenching character at a difficult point in her life. And maybe this is because I do see this in some of my friends, women who have thrown themselves so wholeheartedly into child-rearing that their kids are now a little bit older and they think, wait a minute, who am I mm-hmm. now? Yeah. Was that what you were trying to evoke?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that is something I saw, you know, very close up and personal in my own life, was the idea that when your kids reach a certain age where they have some freedom and independence, it's really exciting, and they're turned into these, you know, wonderful small adults where they begin to process the world. And you need to rethink who you are as a parent. It can't be your sole purpose anymore. And sometimes that comes with major upheaval. Sometimes you realize that once you start to realize you have more time, that maybe you are over-parenting, maybe you're doing too much as a parent, it can really lead to sort of an identity crisis, because that identity has shifted and there's this space now that needs filling, and sometimes people aren't sure how to fill it.
Something else about Claire, that there are echoes of this in several of the characters in the book. Claire wrote a book and had so much promise. I mean, everybody thought that she was headed toward amazing things and never followed up on that book. And the theme of writers being unable to write is echoed in a number of different places. Is this Dean Bacopoulos' greatest fear personified?
You know, I think it probably is. I've never really dealt with writer's block because it's so much a way I get through the day, to get through the world. Like, for me, it'd be like if I was a yoga guru and I just quit doing yoga one day. I really don't think I could survive it. But I think it's a metaphor for the ways we get stuck and the ways we maybe over-censor ourselves. And it comes back to that idea of perfectionism. For me, Claire is a perfectionist, and she wasn't going to have the perfect book again. She wasn't going to have the perfect life in which there was time to write. She wasn't going to have the perfect family, the perfect house. And I think at the core of her dissatisfaction in this novel is this really, tough inner critic she has. And I think it drives her insane a little bit in the book. I think all of the characters see themselves as being, put upon in some different way. But I think for Claire, that really comes from within. And I think that might be the toughest thing to overcome. I think if you feel you have an external enemy, you can get, charged up for a battle and try to overcome it. But when your enemy is your own self, it can really lead to some major, bad decisions, I guess, and upheaval.
Well, and she is someone who would rather not try than to try and fail.
Yeah, and I see that a lot in teaching, especially when I teach writers who are older than my undergrads at Grinnell, when I do a weekend workshop or teach in a graduate program. You have to give everything to it. And there's this great quote. It's in a poem. I hope I get it right because it's not in front of me. But it's a poem by W.S. Merwin, and it's a poem called Berryman. And John Berryman was his famous teacher. And Merwin, in this poem, and I won't get the quote exactly right, but Merwin comes up to Berryman and says, how can I be sure that what I write is any good? And Berryman responds, you can't. You can never be sure. If you have to be sure, don't write. And I think that question of certainty, if you have to be sure, just don't do it. Don't fall in love if you have to be sure it's going to last forever. Don't write if you have to be sure you're going to be a success. Like, you can't be sure. And if you need certainty, you're going to be paralyzed.
I'm talking with Dean Bacopoulos. His newest novel is Summer Long. And Dean, there has been so much press about this novel leading up to today's release. A lot of people are calling this your breakthrough. It's made a lot of summer must-read lists. And, I mean, your other novels got great critical reviews, but not this kind of attention.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
It's really exciting to see this much stuff before publication day. We've had, People Magazine, Esquire Magazine, Vanity Fair, these big slick magazines that often, will frankly ignore a novel set in the Midwest, especially a novel about marriage, which seems to be something that maybe has been done so much that it's hard to get attention for that. I tried to write a Midwestern novel that was different than the usual Midwestern novel. And I tried to write a novel about marriage that was a little more generous and maybe a little more, I think, realistic in terms of the humor of it and the sex that's in the book that sometimes is difficult to write about. I'm really gratified. It feels really like, my publisher, Echo Books, has done such an amazing job figuring out how to talk about this book and to talk about me as an author. And, to be living in the rural Midwest and be getting attention on the coast is wonderful.
reading some of the blurbs about the book, having also read the book, there is a little bit of a disconnect for me at times. I mean, there are a lot of people who want to push this novel as hilarious. Mm-hmm. The word hilarious gets right. used a lot. And there are some very funny moments. Hilarity is not, I think, the overarching theme of the book. I mean, how does it feel when you see the book characterized and you think, oh, maybe not
yeah.
that?
Well, it's better than smutty. I got smutty from somebody. I think it's got its moments of hilarity in the sense that, to me, it's funny when we get into places we can't get out of and we say things and that just get us deeper into it. But yeah, I don't think it's a funny novel in terms of what happens. But, you know, having just gone through this in my personal life, like after divorce is over and after seeing that, like how you acted and reacted and fought and watched everything crumble, there is some humor in it. You know, you have to forgive yourself and look back and be like, oh my goodness, what a year, you know, and that's kind of what I was doing as I was writing the book and just thinking like about not only the characters, but also my own self, being thinking to myself, like, I can't believe this is my life. And sometimes it's really funny to replay these things. And obviously not always, but so I did try to, you know, lace it with enough moments of comic relief that the reader would know that, you know, I was quite aware that these characters were making a lot of their own problems.
I talked with Amy Tan a while back after her latest novel came out, and she doesn't have a lot of sex in her novels, mm-hmm. but in this last one, there were courtesans, so she had to have sex mm-hmm. in the novel. And she talked about how nervous that made her because everybody assumes that everything she writes is about herself.
Right.
So that she figured they would all assume that whatever she wrote, they would assume was happening in their own bedrooms. Did you have some angst about that? Because there's a lot of sex in this book.
Oh, the sex is all true. No, I mean, you know, I kind of was just, you know, I was raised Catholic and I was raised to not talk about sex or admit that I ever thought about it or had it, even though I had two children, like just pretend that never happened. And suddenly I just felt like I was sick of being ashamed of something that is really one of our deepest biological impulses. And it really does, unfortunately, for better or for worse, it controls some of the decisions we make. And it's an important part of a good marriage, and it's an important part of a bad marriage, too. It sometimes is what keeps a bad marriage afloat. And I just wanted to be honest about it. And, you know, I did think that it was sort of fun to write scenes that push the envelope. And I did that partly because we see that in movies or music videos all the time. And we don't really bat an eye because we expect it from Hollywood. But something about being alone with a book and your own thoughts and being forced to imagine the sex scene that the writer has put in front of you makes us feel like it's much more of a big deal. So if this were a movie, yeah, it would be a rated R movie and it'd be kind of a steamy movie. But I don't think people would focus on the sex, which is not, you know, the driving thing in the book. But when you see it in language and you have to kind of imagine the scenes as you read them, it's a much different experience to read and write about sex. So, I mean, yeah, you know, I don't think I'll read these when I'm going to be doing a book tour starting in Grinnell tonight and then looping around the Midwest and the Northeast. I'll be back in Iowa City next Monday at Prairie Lights. And when I read in front of those crowds, I can't see reading the sex scenes aloud, but they are there and they do, you know, they keep people turning pages.
So your first book took place in Michigan. Your second book took place in Wisconsin. This one is in Iowa. Does that mean that you have to move?
Right. I gotta go to Nebraska next. I'm inching my way towards the West Coast. No, it's funny that the Midwest has very much been, you know, the landscape of my imagination. And this novel ends up in the North Shore of Minnesota on Lake Superior, which has been a really sacred place for me and for my kids over the last decade. And I go there every August. And so, you know, I can't ever see not writing about the Midwest, though I've been advised by people to stop, I mean, like to finally break out of this place. But this is where my world is, and this is the place I love. And I have often thought about moving to other places, and I've had teaching job offers in other states. Leaving the Midwest now seems almost impossible to me. I have a feeling I'm going to, unless they run me out of town after this book, I have a feeling I'm going to be in Grinnell for a long time, but you never know. Maybe I'll have to leave after this.
Right. I think that's good news for all of us. So I know that the publication process is long, and clearly you've got a lot of irons in the fire. What's next after the book tour for you?
Well, I'm adapting Summer Long as a screenplay right now, and so I have nothing official to report, but there's interest in Hollywood, and so I wrote the script. I was finishing it late last night, and so I'm going to work in the screenplay mode for a while, and I'm also writing a nonfiction book that I don't know if I'll actually ever publish, but right now I need a break from novels, so screenplays, some nonfiction stuff, and you know, this mystery novel that I've always talked about writing is about 200 pages in, seems like a fun thing to do. I'd like to write about someone other than myself, but we'll see.
Dean Vakopoulos, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And best of luck.
Thanks.
Dean Vakopoulos' latest novel is Summer Long. It's being released today. He'll be celebrating with a launch party and reading at 7 p.m. at Relish in Grinnell. He'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Monday at 7 p.m. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Benjamin Percy, who's taking a little break from writing novels to write comic books. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. A few weeks ago, I interviewed Benjamin Percy about his latest novel, The Deadlands, which is a post-apocalyptic reimagining of the Lewis and Clark expedition. What we didn't talk about at the time were the Green Arrow comic books he was writing. Now, the first of his books has been released, Green Arrow number 41, and now he can talk about them. So we invited him back on the show. Hello, Benjamin Percy.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. So, how did you get involved with comic books?
Well, it's been sort of a long apprenticeship. I began as a reader. I can remember distinctly going to the Mercantile with my mother. I grew up in a small town in rural Oregon, and she would deposit me at the comic rack while she went shopping and filled her card. And I was always permitted one issue, so I very carefully chose it. And I would read Batman, I would read The Thing, I would read Swamp Thing, I would read all of these comics over and over again. My collection was never a collector's collection. It was never worth anything because all of these copies soon became, you know, ragged and soiled, torn along the edges. I still have many of them today. So I began as a reader, really a lifelong reader. I had a bit of a lapse when I was in college and didn't have enough money in the bank account to hit up the shops. But I tried to get into comics. I tried to start writing them. I guess it was back in 2009. And that was when my buddy Scott Snyder made the leap from literary fiction to comics. He started writing Batman stuff. He started writing the series called American Vampire. And it had never really occurred to me that I could do something so awesome as that. So I started, you know, bugging him for information, checking out his pitches, reading very carefully, not just his work, but the work of so many others, especially the Vertigo titles coming out at that time, like Northlanders, which is this Viking saga, and Fables, and many others. And anyways, I sent off this elaborate pitch for a story called Red Moon, and that pitch was rejected. And it's a good thing it was rejected because I wrote it as a novel instead, which, you know, was kind of my breakout novel.
Right, right.
But that was originally a comic series pitch.
Wow. And so, I mean, you say it was good that it was rejected, and I think a lot of people would say, wow, you kind of got lucky that they weren't interested. And then you had this huge success with Red Moon, but you still really wanted to be writing comics?
Yeah, I was just hankering to write some comics. And I sent off a few more pitches, which were rejected. And then when I went to New York one time for a book thing, I ended up meeting with the DC people and just touring the offices, which was so so cool. In the entryway to the DC offices, they had Superman crashing through the ceiling, and there's a phone booth right below him, and that's right at the reception desk, and that's just the beginning of the awesomeness there. So I got to know these people, and it turned out a few years later they needed to fill a gap for Batman. They had two issues that they needed filled. So I sent out a proposal. It got picked up. I wrote this Batman arc for Detective Comics, and that was kind of like my audition for the industry. So a few months later, I'm in, of all places, Florida, boozing it up at a bar when my phone rings, and I sort of blearily answer it. I see a New York number, and I figure it's my agent. And instead, it's DC Comics, this editor, Brian Cunningham, and he asked me, "Do you want to take over Green Arrow?" And I said, "Heck yeah."
So, by taking over Green Arrow for a while, what does that mean?
Well, I should first say that Patrick Zercher, who is this tremendously talented artist and industry veteran, was assigned first to Green Arrow. And he created a short list of writers he was interested in working with. I was one of them.
Wow. So the artist kind of handpicked you.
Yeah. Well, he, you know, it wasn't just me. There were a few others in the running for this. And I sent in another one of those big, elaborate pitches. And it just so happened that mine was the one chosen. So he and I are a team. You know, we make our creative decisions together. I write the scripts, he draws it, but as he draws it, as I write it, there's always this back and forth occurring. We're in communication constantly.
In reading a comic book, there's such a, I don't know, conserving of language. I mean, there just aren't a lot of words, although the story is rich, and of course it's told so much through pictures as well. As a novelist, is that hard for you to write so little?
It's a funny sort of thing because even though you're not seeing that many words, I'm writing so many words. My scripts are quite elaborate, probably too much so. I describe every panel at length, and I'm doing it as I would as a novelist or as a screenwriter might. So in a panel, let's say you're situated below, and you're looking up at this Ferris wheel that's spinning, and it's aglow with light, and the cityscape is beyond it, and the moon is hanging in the sky. You know, I'll describe that at length, and then Patch will he'll you know he'll change some things, he'll use other things, but he's using my words as a launch pad for his own vision. So I might have a, let's say it's a 2-page spread. When I did that Batman, those Batman issues, I had this one scene where a plane crashes through this atrium and mayhem ensues. And this is something that's spread over 2 pages, so it's quite this elaborate set piece. The artist JP Leon, like one of my most treasured possessions right now, is he sent me that 2-page spread, and it's hanging on my office wall. But it took me probably 5 pages to describe all the madness that was occurring just in that one image.
So, when you send that off and the artist works on it, then do you get it back and you see what language was chosen? How does that work?
Well, the language that's actually included in the comic are my narration captions. So I'll
Okay.
have, let's say, the interior life of Oliver Queen slash Green Arrow. You know, he might be narrating one of the comics, or sometimes it's an omniscient narration. So I'll have what's going through his brain at the time, which is no different than, you know, writing a short story and having maybe a bit of an unreliable first-person narrator. So I have these captions, and then I also have my dialogue bubbles. So those two things, that's the writing that's actually being shared with the reader. Everything else I'm writing for the artist.
All right, so it's a lot like writing a script for a television show or
It's
something like
exactly
that,
like
where,
that.
okay. How long does this process take to put together one issue?
Well, it takes a lot longer for the artist. I have to say that these guys are workhorses. They're putting in the two artists I work with, JP Leon and Patrick Zercher. They're putting in 10 to 12-hour days to get an issue done on time. Everything is very last minute in this industry. So they're just hustling and hustling and hustling, and then they send out maybe a page a day, And that page is then reviewed by the editors and by the colorist and by me. And we probably don't make any revisionary remarks. We're going to respond more in the way of encouragement because there's just no time left. And then the colorist takes over, and the colorist, goes in and splashes the page with reds and yellows and grays and blacks. And then the letterer comes in and puts in, there's actually a title for the letterer. Like, that's a special position within comics. And then the letterer goes in and does the dialogue and the sound effects and the narration.
With a comic book series, of course, there have been many authors who have come before. How much research did you have to do to pick it up and keep going? I mean, I know that you created your own storyline, but there's a lot of history there that has to be incorporated too. How do you research that?
Yeah, it's a tricky sort of thing because you're incorporating this larger mythology, but you also want to make it your own. My initial pitch, I tried too heavily to make it my own, and they asked me to, rein myself in a little bit. I actually wanted to make Green Arrow, half Caucasian, half black, and that didn't roll. I also wanted to change his origin story. That didn't roll.
To make him from Ames, Iowa? Was that? No.
No. But I did have, I was able to incorporate quite a lot of original ideas.
Okay.
But here I am tipping my hat to Denis O'Neil. Denis O'Neil was writing in the 70s and doing some stuff with Green Arrow and Green Lantern, where, he was a sort of a socially, politically progressive hero. He was very in tune to the troubles of the times. There's a very famous issue that concerned Green Arrow's sidekick Speedy getting addicted to heroin, for example. But here you are in this tumultuous time in American history, and the comic was really reflecting that. And it was kind of an essential moment for comics in general because it was a bridge away from camp. It was a bridge toward like seriousness, and it kind of paved the way for the 80s, in which comics became like high art. I'm not saying they weren't artful before, but they became like almost like HBO shows right now. They became really literary, really dark, and oftentimes reflective of the era in which they were created. So I'm tipping my hat to Denis O'Neil. I'm tipping my hat to Mike Grell, who's one of those great Green Arrow writers from the past, most known for his Longbow Hunters, which is, R-rated territory. And then also Jeff Lemire, who had a recent run with Green Arrow, and I'm borrowing from a few things he did. So yeah, you're piecing together these various mythologies and at the same time giving it your own turn.
Now, you're no stranger to working politics into your fiction, but does and politics are a big part of the storyline that you're creating in Green Arrow. Does this give you an opportunity to work in political situations with more immediacy than you can as a novelist?
Absolutely, yeah. You write a novel and you're going to be working on that thing for years. And the headlines of today might not be so striking then, when it actually hits the shelves. I'm able to produce material now, some of which is ripped from the headlines, that will be in a reader's hand 2 or 3 months later. And that is incredibly gratifying, especially to someone with a impatient personality. I like to speedily produce fiction. I like to connect with readers. Sometimes writing novels feels a little maddening because you're so, you're in the dark, disconnected from everyone for so long.
And you are getting already some press. I saw an article in The Guardian about your storyline saying Green Arrow to provide pointed critique of Baltimore and Ferguson. I mean, people are paying attention to what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for that. Green Arrow's sort of been under the radar for a while, and I'm hoping to bring him back into the mainstream. There was a time, the Mike Grell era, when Green Arrow was one of the, best-selling titles at DC. I'm not betting the farm on that happening, but I do hope that we get into more and more readers' hands, and I think that you know, the Guardian article and other press that we've gotten, it just speaks to the fact that we're striking a nerve. These first three issues have an incendiary, veiled parallel to what's been happening in places like Baltimore and Ferguson. And, you know, it's not editorial commentary. I don't want to be bossy or preachy with any fiction that I write, but it's raising important questions.
When we talked a couple of months ago about the Deadlands, you couldn't talk about the storyline at all in Green Arrow. And I guess, call me naive, but I was surprised by how much secrecy was surrounding the comic books. This world, clearly, it's bigger with higher stakes than I imagine.
Well, comic book fans are intense. I've never dealt with this much social media pressure before on any project I've worked on. People are checking in with me daily, and sometimes they're applauding what I'm doing, and sometimes they're railing against me. And in the months prior to Green Arrow's release, there were a lot of questions, and many of them I wasn't allowed to answer due to a gag order. And people seem really happy so far with what we're doing. I'm sure that will change. You know, give it time. People start to nitpick. People start to get grumpy about one thing or another. You know, one area right now where people are, you know, there's all sorts of Reddit boards, you know, and wikis devoted to these sort of discussions. But one thing where people are sort of divided is there's the show Arrow on CW, and then there's the comic series Green Arrow. They're not the same thing. Right, and for a while, the show's writers were writing the comic, and so it was the same thing. Mm. But when when Patch and I took over, our charge was don't make it like the show. As a result of that, you know, we booted a bunch of characters and changed a bunch of stuff.
And you've also created a new character that was introduced in the first issue, right?
Yeah, the dog, the dog slash wolf. There's a secret history to the dog slash wolf. George, that I can't, again, here's the gag order, I can't quite get into now, but he's going to play a very important role in the comics.
All right, and that sounds like a very Benjamin Percy character. How does that feel to create your first comic book character?
Oh, I created another one, too, the Alabaster Man, as he's known. that creepy guy with the white skin roaming around in the background of that first issue, the Alabaster Man.
All right.
It's actually funny how you create these characters, and then you have to actually kind of, you go in and you copyright them, you know, just in case somebody else uses them in the future.
Wow. And do you see more comic books in your future?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this sounds cheesy, but it really is like childhood dream come true writing these. I love writing comics. And I've sent out a few pitches for some other series, some of them continuations of existing characters, some of them original, and I really hope some of them get picked up.
What's your dream? Which comic book would you write if you could pick anyone?
Well, I really would love to write Swamp Thing. I know that kind of sounds kind of silly, but like that, the Alan Moore era of Swamp Thing was so, so good. I would love to write Swamp Thing. I would love to write Warlord. I would love to write more Batman. And on and on. I
mean, all right. Well, we'll be following along. Benjamin Percy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Benjamin Percy is writing the Green Arrow comic books this summer. The first issue, number 41, that he has written has already been released. He's also the author of The Deadlands. I spoke to him about that novel just a couple of months ago. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.